You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Transition Wild Podcast, the home for those looking for expertise and inspiration on all things Western big game hunting. I'm your host, Adam Parr, and you're listening to episode number 20, where we talk with Jason Dickens about high country archery mule deer. What's going on, guys? Hope you're having a great day. I can't believe it's already July. It's end of June when I'm recording this right now, but where's the summer going? I really don't understand. Can life maybe just slow down for a few minutes? I'd like to have some time to prepare for this year's elk season and hunting season, but it's just not going to happen. So we're just going to keep grinding. I've been busy. I've been on some work travel in Texas the last, that was a week or so ago. Went down there for some meetings for work, and then I was able to get out and do a little hog hunting with the guys from Sniper Hog Lights. I met them a couple years ago when I did the Texas Trophy Hunters Association trade shows, and real good guys. Great to hunt with Jason, Rob, and Joe, and they put me up for a couple days, put me in their best spots, and I was able to kill a pig, and that was really, really fun. And didn't get it done with a recurve, although I talk and post a lot of pictures about hashtag trad life, and I'm some big bad trad hunter now. Not really, but I kind of perceived that image on Instagram, or at least I try to do. But anyways, I missed one the first night with a trad bow, and I decided if I actually wanted to kill something, I realized traditional archery hunting is not easy with a recurve. And I decided, hey, I better grab a compound bow from one of the guys down there if I wanted to kill something. And that's what I did. I decided I'd rather, you know, that meant more to me to, you know, take something down than, you know, miss one and come home empty-handed. I don't want to sound shallow, but hey, you go down there to hunt and hopefully get something. That's what I did. So thanks again to Sniper Hog Lights and the guys down there. Check out their stuff. I use their headlamp, their 40KP headlamp for tracking. It's the brightest thing you'll ever see when you're brightest light you'll ever use for a headlamp. So if you want to turn night into day when you're tracking something at night, definitely check them out, Sniper Hog Lights. Let's see. So when I was down in Texas, I met Jason Dickens, who we have on the show today, and he's just a really cool guy, and we got to talking and trading stories, and found out, you know, he blogs and has his own website, and you know, has done some guiding in Colorado, and he's a young dude. He's only 23, and he's got tons of experience on the mountain and Western hunts. He lives in Texas, but guides and hunts out west, you know, pretty much every year. So I really wanted to pick his brain on high country archery mule deer, because he's telling me about the story. He shot this buck in velvet and, you know, glassing and being up basically 13,000 feet. And so you're above tree line. It's not easy conditions. It's a pretty unique hunt. So we dive into a lot of his story and tactics and you know, strategy and how he got it done this past season. Let's see, that would have been the 2017 season. He shot a beautiful archery you know, velvet mule deer above tree line. It's just like kind of the perfect hunt that I envision for myself when I go down that road. So it's really cool. Had a great time talking with him. Before we get into that, I've, as I mentioned a few months back, I've kind of been on the prowl, or, you know, I'm looking to possibly get some partners for the podcast, and you know, so I kind of wanted to announce the first one, and that is Heads Up Decoy. I have worked actually with Garrett for a while, and not only worked with him, but I've been using, ever since I moved out to Colorado, when I started hunting Kansas more often, open country, I actually reached out to Garrett. That would have been in 2015, and said, "Hey, like, I really like your product. I want to use it." And you know, ever since then, I've had it with me on every whitetail, a lot of my whitetail hunts, all my western hunts, elk hunting, and it's just a cool product. If you haven't listened to the episode with Heads Up Decoy, Garrett Rowe, go back. I think it's episode number two or three. Go check that out. And I've had some pretty amazing encounters with that decoy. It's portable, lightweight, realistic. I don't know. Check it out. It's something I believe in, and I wouldn't have them as a partner of this podcast if I didn't absolutely believe in the product and use the product firsthand. So go check them out. I want to announce them as a partner, and you know, looking forward to having them associated with Transition Wild for many years to come, because it's a great product. I believe in it. Check them out, headsupdecoy.com. All right. One last thing before we get started here, make sure you check out sportsmansnation.com. You can subscribe there. You can go to iTunes, subscribe to the Western Big Game feed. There's the whitetail side. I'm on the Western Big Game side. So subscribe there, leave some good feedback. I love all the reviews, all the emails I get. So please keep that coming. If you haven't been over to Transition Wild in a while, I've updated the latest kind of freebie for the site. So if you subscribe, you get the Colorado Beginner Elk Hunting Guide for free. So give me your email and I will send you that PDF, 10-page, you know, kind of get you off and started with elk hunting in Colorado, covering scouting, gear, preparation, where to hunt, when to hunt, and just kind of all around tips and tactics and hopefully inspiration. So if Colorado elk is on the books, whether it's archery or rifle for 2018, head over to transitionwild.com, subscribe. I will send you that for free. All right, I've babbled enough. This has been a hugely long intro, and I appreciate you sticking with me. A really cool episode, lots of information. Again, he's a young dude, but man, Jason's got worlds of experience so far being a guide and avid hunter itself. So I really enjoyed this one. Let's give it up for Jason Dickens. All right, on the line with us now we have Jason Dickens from Texas. How you doing today, man?
Doing good, Adam. How you doing? I'm a little hot down here. I'm sure you're feeling better up where you're at. So.
Well, yeah, long time no see. I was just down there 2 weeks ago, and pretty sure I was sweating my nuts off the whole time, but
yeah, we were slinging arrows, and actually I was breaking arrows up there with the recurve, and you were actually slinging them. So I finally got my compound put together, so I can actually hit the target now, which is a relief. So
yeah, that's it was fun because I was down there actually for Quiet Cat and doing some meetings, and shipped a bike into Six Sight, which we'll get into here in a bit, and putting the bike together and just sweating, and then you know, you and I go upstairs and we're starting to shoot our bows, and it's just like a whole nother 10 degrees
up there.
Oh yeah, that was bad. But hey, when you're shooting a bow, you'll go through anything, right?
Just about anything. the heat, I don't know, there I think I would go, there's a max on the heat. I'll shoot it any cold weather, but up there whenever it gets a little hot and sweaty. But I guess that's my excuse for why that one arrow flung off. Maybe my hands were too sweaty and I missed it, I guess. That's a good excuse. So,
hey, you got to have an excuse for everything. That's what I found out. And when you come back, something went wrong, you got to make up an excuse, even if there's not one, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the whole goal behind being a good hunter. You always have a good excuse. That's why I go by, at least.
And that's why I go by myself a lot, right? So you don't have anybody to tell you what you did wrong.
I agree 100% with that.
Well, cool, man. So you're down in Texas. You and I met a couple weeks ago when I was down there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell us a little bit about, for people that don't know, tell us a little bit about Six Sight Gear and what you do with them.
All right. Well, Six Sight Gear, we're based out of Dallas, Texas. Kind of the short overview of it, it's just technical hunting gear. Think of your Sitka, your Kuyus, Six Sights, right along with them, with the quality of the gear, and Navy SEAL designed, American built. Stephen Hawley. We started the company 2.5-3 years ago, and he's been piecing, sewing everything together bit by bit, piece by piece, and slowly but surely, I guess they're coming around and trying to get into that hard market that is the outdoor industry. I'm working for them this summer as their first intern. So I'm doing anything and everything from doing oil processing and shipping. If you order anything with us this summer, I'll probably box stuff and send it to you. And then we'll do crazy, stupid things in there as play home run derby or shoot the bows. And we'll even get some hands-on stuff. We're kind of messing with the new prototypes that have coming out, adding pieces here, pieces there. And then all the marketing and talking finance. And so I'm getting, I guess you can say, I'm pretty good overall view of what the outdoor industry is from more of a indoor perspective rather than the outdoor perspective.
Yeah, for sure. You get to kind of see the business from all angles, and that's what it's all mm-hmm. about, especially when you're interning. Mm-hmm. I got to get Steven on the podcast at some point here in the near future, because him and I wouldn't say we're like good friends, but you know, we've definitely stayed in contact since we've met since last February, and he's just a cool dude, man. He's unique. What's it like working for him?
He can be quietly intimidating, I guess you can say.
As a Navy SEAL, I'm sure.
Anytime you're working with someone the caliber of person like him and the skills that he has acquired. The other day, actually, I have a game. I throw balls at him, and I hit him in the face a couple times, and they're really good shots. And he turned around to me, and he just said, "Revenge is a dish best served cold," and then just walked off.
Uh-oh.
And that was 2 weeks ago, and he still hasn't got me back yet. So I don't know if it's going to be whenever we're at Hunt together or what, but I'm sure eventually I'm going to get something back that'll be hurting, I'm sure. he's definitely driven. He's the kind of guy that doesn't say no to anything. He finds a way to get the job done. So that kind of anytime any field or anytime you're working for someone like that, that's something where you just find a way, whatever job you're doing, no matter how big or small, you find a way to get it done. Him and the other guys in the office, a lot of experience about him and a lot of leadership skills that anyone could see that and just soak it in and get pieces and parts here and there that are just going to benefit you the more you go into whatever job you go into. So
yeah exactly. That's really cool. Soak it up, man. And you're just finishing up college, or you just graduated? Tell us a little about that.
I'm a senior at Texas A&M right now. I think it'll only be my senior for like almost not just under 2 years, I guess you could say. So I'm kind of soaking in the final run. I have 3 classes in the fall I'll be finishing up, and then that allows me to get one more fall in of the hunting guiding and kind of the hunting scheme. So I'm kind of happy with that. And once December comes around, I'll be graduated with a degree from there, then figure out what we'll do whenever I grow up. So we'll see what happens.
Hey man, soak up that college life for as long as you can. Although the work life is, you know, it's not bad. I'm not going to sit here and complain about it by any means.
Yeah.
But I look back on college, it's like, damn, I wish I was there a few more years.
and we keep on getting guys come in the store, and they keep on telling me everything I hear is that getting old sucks. So I'm like, man, I don't know if I want to get old. People walk in like, oh, I just got my shoulder done, or I got my ankle reconstructed. And I'm like, man, don't be telling me that.
I'm not looking forward to getting old either. That's why I try to keep hunting, man. It keeps me in good shape, keeps me motivated, keeps me physically active, and I'm just gonna keep doing that mm-hmm. for a while. That's my plan.
The motivation aspect. You go on the mountains or anywhere, unprepared and not ready to go, and it'll humble you real quickly, and you realize you're like, oh, I need to run a little more, maybe do a couple extra reps of this because of the payoff. It, no matter what, the suck factor is going to be there. It's just a matter of
how much.
How much.
That's exactly right. And I definitely want to pick your brain, on all that. But before we kind of get into Western hunting, and we'll talk about your guiding experience And then later, I really want to dive into your high country mule deer archery hunts, and because there's a cool story mm-hmm. there, you're telling me about it. Talk to us a little bit about how you got into hunting. Was that something that you grew up doing as a young kid? Did you get introduced by your father? Was it in the family? Tell us a little bit mm-hmm. how you got started.
Well, grew up on a ranch west of San Angelo, Texas. So until people think of El Paso, but come 6 hours east and you'll find us in the desert over there. And dad was a pretty big hunter growing up, and it was just something that growing up on the ranch, I had a little 22 in my hand. I don't even know if I ever even had a pellet gun. They just gave me a 22 and started off rabbit hunting. And I think I killed my first deer, whitetail, at 8 or 9 years old. And dad was with me. And then at 13, I started bow hunting. And on my ninth animal I shot at, I finally hit a 8-point buck with my bow. And I've been addicted to bow hunting ever since. And just growing up, even through high school, we did a little elk hunting, but nothing really too extreme. We were hunting some of the same areas I hunt now, but I just didn't have the drive or kind of the motivation to go about doing it. When I was 15, I shot my first elk with a muzzleloader, and that was a real fun experience. And definitely, the spark was definitely there, but it wasn't until 18 or 19, whenever I kind of got a little bigger, got a little stronger, and realized that I had almost a stupid factor about me, to where I could just, I didn't care how hard it was or how cold it was, I was just going to go hike and hike and hike. And so I kind of caught that bug, and thought about, of course, every kid, whenever they get out of high school, I wanted to go be some professional hunter and be on TV, and soon realized that about a million other people on Instagram or Facebook are like that. And so I found ways to help people the best I could. And I found that I was had a little bit of a talent in helping people with guiding. And so I just opened myself up, being a packer, helping where I could. I'd meet people on the side of the road, out in the forest area, and just be like, hey, if you get an animal down, here's my number, I'll come help you. Just pay me in pizza. So slowly but surely, that kind of started evolving, and still been doing a lot of my whitetail hunting. I actually started doing a lot of spot and stalk whitetail hunting with my bow. I figured while I couldn't hunt out west, I could get the experience needed and learn the ins and outs of the hunting on the ground. And that's one thing that really helped me with my mule deer hunt we'll talk about is getting close to these whitetail. I mean, I've had hunts 10 or 15 yards away, got within easy bow range of them and shot them. And I'm just learning the patience and the stalk, and learning how to be always optimistic in what you're doing. And you truly learn a way. And this kind of goes in more to the guiding stuff as well, but you learn a way not just to hunt animals, but how to actually go out there and kill them. That may mean to be, you're going out there and just knowing exactly how to do it. There is no, I don't know if I get it. It's just, you get a lot more confident. And I guess a lot of the wild hunting brought me that, and then the guiding as well. And you get more confident in your moves and patient, and you just, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but that's one thing that whitetail hunting has really helped me to do, and the guiding with a lot of this Western hunting.
Yeah, it's really cool. One thing that I took note of, or was pretty remarkable about you, is it seems, you're a young guy, and you've had a lot of Western experience, a lot of hunting experience for being, mm-hmm. what are you, like mid-20s or what?
23.
Yeah, so you're very young.
Yeah.
And and to have, already killed an elk, mule deer, whitetail, had a number of Western trips, you've done some guiding, that's mm-hmm. that's pretty rare to have that much experience for such a young age, which is really cool.
And I don't know if I mentioned, did I tell you about my work in Africa?
Man, I think you did, and I saw some pictures, I believe, on your Instagram page. But yeah tell us a little bit about that.
So I was a year ago right now, I was actually able to work in a northern South Africa. For any of y'all wondering, it's the Mpumalanga province. Don't ask me to spell it. I can't spell it.
Yeah, sounds crazy.
But yeah, I, I was able to work there for 2 months for a safari company, doing anything from walking through the brush, looking for poachers and my short shorts with a machete to we were on the banks with hippos and crocs and elephants. And I learned a lot over there from the PH's, professional hunters, the guides, and also the trackers. So that was something that was really able to further me and my abilities and understanding in the whole hunting world. Truly a once in a lifetime experience. It was a blast over there.
How did you get hooked up with that whole deal?
So the short story, I guess, whenever I was 15, we had a friend of ours who planned a huge safari, and 2 days before the safari, he could not go. And so he called dad and said, "Hey, do you want to go on a safari?" And he said, "Only if I can bring my son." And so our friend said yes. And so my dad asked, "Well, how long until the safari?" And he's like, "Well, your flight leaves out in a day."
Oh, wow.
And so, so we had to prepare to go hunt, and we all had a great time over there hunting in South Africa. And always stayed in touch with the PH, and I'd see him every 2 years or so. Never really, we'd just see him at a show and say hi. And it's about almost 2 years ago now, I just emailed him out of the blue saying, "Hey, if I got myself to Africa, could I live with you and see what y'all did?" And he said, "Yep, come on." So there really was no planning. I just knew I was going to Africa and going to work for the guy. So,
wow, that's really cool, man. And honestly, like what you're doing now, like getting involved in so many different things and not necessarily mm-hmm. worrying about the grind and the paycheck and whatever, just follow mm-hmm. some passions, get involved, get some experience. Mm-hmm. You know, you're working in the hunting industry right now. You've had a number of experiences. Everything you're doing sounds like, I mean, you're just building a foundation for what you want to do later in life. Mm-hmm. And you've been able to do some pretty amazing things so far. So keep it up. And you know, I definitely admire that for sure.
Yeah, the more people I can surround myself with know the ins and outs, and I've done a lot more things than I can, the better off I know I'll be, and the better off I'll be able to enhance other people in life and also in the hunting world in particular. So yeah, I've been blessed to do a lot of things, and hopefully we'll do a lot more here in the future.
For sure. So how did you get into guiding in Colorado? Did that come along a couple years ago, or is that something recently you got involved with?
That was whenever I was 19. I had an elk tag, my first elk tag ever. And I hunted for 4 weeks, not knowing what I was doing. Passed up too many bulls. One of my good buddies, my best buddy, gives me a lot of crap because I passed up a lot of bulls because it wasn't the right animal in the right situation. I had a fun time doing that and kind of was like, man, I enjoy this Western hunting. I love the challenge. And I had a good friend of ours who was running an outfitter in that same unit. And they allowed me to tag on. And another good buddy of mine, who's like a dad figure to me, he had some hunts. And I tagged along there and learned a lot about it. And just kind of the few falls after that, I was able to enhance my skills and learn the ins and outs of the Colorado hunting, and just really kind of took off from there. And so every fall since then, I think I've taken off two fall semesters from school, which doesn't help with getting school done, but it sure does help with keeping my sanity. I've just been doing my best to help people, and a lot of the guys I've been guided with, other than with outfitters and whatnot, I've just met a lot of guys on sites like Rock Slide or Texas Bow Hunter, or even the bush out in the woods, and just offer to help. And a lot of them I knew, they may know a few more things than I did, but I knew the unit we were hunting better and was able to help them and get some stuff. And yeah, so a lot of us just offer myself up to help people and be willing to learn. And sure enough, I've learned a couple things, and now people are asking me where to go, what to do, and how to do it. So,
yeah, well, sounds like you got the experience. And so are you guiding, or have you guided for both elk and mule deer?
Yep. Elk, muzzleloader, archery, and rifle. mule deer rifle only. So my my mule deer hunt with my bow was actually my first ever experience of any archery type of area with using my bow to hunt any type of mule deer. So, but yeah, usually elk is what we'll see the most of. The tags are a little easier to come by, and especially if Colorado, you have the over-the-counter units. A lot of my buddies will go up there and hunt, definitely know a little more about elk, especially in the calling sense, communicating with them and whatnot. But definitely have fallen in love with the lure of the high country deer.
Yeah, that's really cool. And before we get into that, like what with guiding, I mean, that's got to be a whole different ball game as far as like hunting is one thing, but when you've got like multiple people mm-hmm. and you're trying to get them on something to kill something, that's just got to be a whole nother challenge in the books. Talk to us a little bit about that dynamic, mm-hmm. like guiding people and, you know, getting in close and maybe some of the differences of hunting by yourself versus having somebody with you.
Mm-hmm. So, the biggest difference I find, especially with, having someone that, maybe you're not necessarily in charge of them, but you're overseeing their actions. And, in most cases, they don't know as much about that particular area or even species you're hunting, compared to hunting by yourself. A lot of it, your mental aspect, whenever you're by yourself, you have to stay a little more mentally sharp, especially in the long periods of the day where you have nothing going on, or you mess up a few stalks here and there and you just start kind of self-doubting yourself and you're having to make decisions, and you have no one to bounce ideas back and forth with. That's one of the good, especially up here in Colorado, whenever up there and we got a team of guys or two or three guys, and we're looking at a situation where we got to move in on an animal. One of us may have a good idea and another one may have a good idea, and we can combine those two to make a solid game plan. And so being able to bounce ideas back and forth, and especially in the calling sense, having the caller, having your caller step back 70, 80 yards, and especially if you have two guys, we even have setups where I would step back 70, 80 yards. One of the hunters would set the decoy, and another hunter with the muzzleloader, or the archer, or with his bow would be set up, and just the group effort, especially in those, you can just game plan. I wouldn't say game plan better, but you can be a little more sharp on your decisions and get more views. And but with the hunting by myself, I found that I can get mad a lot more often and be really frustrated and throw things around because no one's there to see it. So I don't know how many times I've thrown my bow or thrown my pack or having to go get my rangefinder or just sat down and pouted for a while because it can be really draining, especially if you're starting out and you're trying to figure out things. And if you know what you're doing, if you work for 5-6 hours to try to get an animal and all of a sudden just runs away, or you do something stupid, you're just like, man, I'm the worst hunter in the world. I find that with guiding, you can do all that work, and then up to the final moment, I can do everything I can. The final result solely relies on the hunter himself. It's all about his trigger release or his squeezing the trigger.
Yeah, and executing the shot.
I can't look through those crosshairs for him. I can make sure that he's in good shape and has the good shot presentation. And so I've had a lot of guys, we miss, wound one, and so it then turns my job as they're down and pissed off and just, they're going through all the feelings I've gone through before. I just got to stay positive, got to stay optimistic, like, hey, you know, we're just going to keep on going. And basically, you got to find the fine line between pushing them past their comfort zone, but not pushing them too far to I've had some guys get mad at me because I'm pushing them too far, but it's because they're just wussing out. And then at the end, they're like, man, I'm glad you pushed me. But there's a fine line between pushing them hard enough to where they can reach their potential, but then push them too hard where they walk themselves into injury or get elevate or altitude sickness up there. And so that's kind of the fine line you got to find, the right motivation up there, especially after a missed opportunity or missed shot. And once you get into the end of the week, or you've hunted for 5-10 days, and you're just opportunity after opportunity. And that's the biggest thing, I think, is staying optimistic and then making sure that whoever you're hunting with sees that optimism and just can play off that. And I mean, just a little bit of that can go a long way, especially in these hard hunts, especially in the public land backcountry stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's probably the biggest thing. I'd say the mental aspect, and you're just being able to bounce ideas off of people. Cause I've done some stalks and I got done and I'm like, I have no clue why I even tried to do that. That's the stupidest idea in the world.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Been there. Yeah, I've been there, done that.
That's a great comment. Anyone who says they haven't been there and done that is definitely lying. So.
Yeah, or haven't hunted long enough. One of the two.
Yeah. Or they've never made, or they've just never made a good decision. Opinions always make the bad ones.
Yeah. But, yeah, for sure. Well, that's cool. I mean, the whole guiding thing, I'm sure it helps you with your own hunts, and you're getting, again, mm-hmm. a lot of experience jam-packed into a small amount of time, because, you know, for the average person to do like one, let's say one week hunt, maybe 2 week long hunts a year for a certain mm-hmm. species, where you're getting to see, you know, yourself multiple, you know, 4 or 5 weeks or more of hunting and guiding and just being out there, it's you're able to pack in, you know, a couple, 2, 3, 4 years of experience just into one season, which is mm-hmm. which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, you can stay busy. I mean, their seasons that start in the middle of August, and you can go all the way through September, and then your rifle season's through October and halfway through November. And then for me, I'll come back home and we still have seasons in Texas, so I'll be doing stuff, whitetail hunts all the way through February. And then we're always having friends wanting to go shoot hogs and whatnot throughout the spring and the summer. And so you're just a lot of more opportunity. And it's also, I tell people, it's almost the cheap guy's ways to hunt, because you do everything but pull the trigger and you don't pay the license fee. So it's perfect.
Yeah. That's a great way of looking at it, for sure. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun being there and being part of the experience and seeing the joy and seeing some tough dudes just brought to tears from just the excitement. And then hearing the stories later, it's usually the stuff you don't realize that happened, but then you hear later and you realize the influence you actually have on people and influence the outdoors and the experience and the hunting. Hunting is important, but a lot of times it's the experience they get out there. And then once we get that animal and just all that emotion comes to the peak, and it's truly amazing what some guys would just, some guys would say stuff like, I would never thought you'd have said something so poetic or so just beautiful. I was like, you've been rugged all week, and all of a sudden you're over here crying and you're so happy. And I'm just like, man, I had a part of that. That's just, it's one of the coolest things in the world. So
I bet. So let's jump into some of that high country archery mule deer hunting. And because I was pretty intrigued when I met you down in Texas, you were telling me about the story and all that stuff. And I have yet to mule deer hunt. And I had one guy on the podcast so far, and we talked about mule deer hunting, mm-hmm. but one of it was, rifle public land. So it was like later season with snow in Montana. And then, mm-hmm. He also hunts in Wyoming on a private ranch, which definitely has its set of challenges, but it's low elevation, mm-hmm. 5,000 feet. And, it's a completely different dynamic than what you're going for. And something, when you're above tree line, it's hard to describe if you haven't been up there, but it's just a different world. And I'm really excited to kind of just talk to you about, that whole experience and kind of diving into everything, if that sounds good to you.
My disclaimer is that it can be truly terrifying.
Yeah, I can see that.
We jump on that, and I love talking about it. It's one of those things that, the fortunate thing was my hunt was successful. The unfortunate thing is it didn't take me very long for it to be successful. That was due to a lot of the scouting and just knowing the animals I was hunting and the process I went through and just being patient and then choosing my time to strike and I tell people I found one dumb enough to let me shoot it. That was all there was. So.
Yeah, well, so you talk about scouting, and obviously you've been kind of in this area before, this particular unit, whether guiding or whatnot. So that was kind of maybe your base starting point, right? But like, talk to us a little bit about maybe digital scouting. Did you use Google Earth at all, and kind of the preparation of maybe kind of dissecting that unit or that particular area, and the steps you maybe go through to kind of get up there and start picking it apart?
So, of course, if anything, and anyone who's read any online forum, the boots on the ground or driving around is always the best idea. Because a lot of I love digital scouting. I mean, I'm on Onyx Maps at least a few minutes every day, just kind of checking out a point, or I get an idea and check something. And being able to turn what you see online and what you see on your topo map, being able to translate that into what it'll actually be whenever you get out there, that's something that it still gets me. I'll be like, oh, well, I'll hike up. I have a mile and I have 1,000 vertical feet. I should be able to do it in however many minutes. And then I get there. I mean, the thing just looks nothing like I'd imagined. And then what I thought would be a glassing area isn't a glassing area. And so one of the things that, from Texas, for me to drive up from San Angelo to where we hunt is about 13 hours. So, I mean, you're not going to be doing a weekend trip up there.
Yeah.
But I tell people, any reason to kind of get up there, find a reason to go vacation nearby, or find a reason just to sneak up there for a day or two and just see what the country looks like, and see what the country looks like. And I'm having to answer the door real quick.
Yeah, no worries. No worries.
Oh, hold on one second. Yes, sir.
Hey, my name is Ron. I'm with Texans for Greg Abbott. I was curious if I can ask you a couple quick questions.
I'm on a conference call right now. I apologize.
Can you at least tell me, do you plan to vote for Governor Abbott?
Yes, we do.
All right, thank you. Have a good day.
What did that guy want?
Sorry about that.
What did he want?
he wants me to vote for Greg Abbott, which I will be doing. He's the best governor we've ever had. So.
All right. Go Greg.
Sorry about that.
Oh, you're good.
Go Greg Abbott.
You're good.
But he personally has my vote, so. I was hoping he wasn't wearing a white shirt and a black tie and asking me if I knew my Lord Jesus Christ, my Savior. So that's what I thought he was. But okay, as we were saying, sorry about that.
Oh, you're good. So you're talking about scouting and kind of relaying that, and it's tough to get up there, you know, just for weekend stuff.
Yeah, and so finding ways to incorporate family vacations, or just find a way to get up there. I mean, the summertime, especially in Colorado, you can go fishing, and finding a way, just a day up there, just to see what the country looks like. I mean, that'll change everything whenever you go back and look at Onyx, whenever you look at Google Earth and you read in your topos. Let's see. And then one of the biggest things up there we find, especially, I love the topos because we can see the different depressions and then the ridge lines and see where the saddles are at. And up in southwest Colorado, our westerlies are a big deal. And so, as with anything, whenever your thermals play a big part in your hunting. So in the morning, they're coming down. And then as the day heats up, they rise up. And then as the evening coolness comes in, they sink down again. And so, of keeping that in mind, we also have to play with the westerlies, as our westerlies are a main wind as well. And so in some areas where it's real open, the wind, I mean, anywhere can be swirling, but I've even had some situations where in the morning the wind's coming straight up a mountainside. And so, and being able just to be there and scout and being like, all right, well, whenever there's cloudy day and storms come in, our wind's completely opposite of what it should be. And so that, I had a couple of spots like that where I hunt and shot my mule deer, to where I was understanding what the wind was doing exactly. And it's one of the things that the wind is it's a bad person. It's ruined a lot of hunts for me. And just being able to look at a topo map and understand what it is, and then knowing the wind conditions around there. And I think there's some weather apps you can get. I think Weather Underground. You can pinpoint certain locations and see exactly what the wind is doing at that moment. And of course you have to pattern it through time.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of variables
and,
there.
Yep. And one of the bigger things I tell people, like, for my hunt, I had scouted areas that I'd hike in 4 or 5 miles, and I had actually done my research and found a couple big bucks that had been killed in the unit. I mean, deer that are over 200, they're the 200 inch class bucks. I mean, some big deer. And one of them, I found the general area due to a picture. I tell people, be careful of the pictures you post, because if there's any ridge line or any mountain in them, I can probably find where it's at.
That's probably the best advice you'll hear from in today's agents, you know, society or with social media and everything. It's, you got to be careful.
It's and please don't ever post a picture of your map. I had one guy do that, and I had to DM him and tell him. I was like, oh, it's a cool picture, I know, but I was like, so many people have access, and so many people just don't care. And if they see somewhere, they're just going to go blow it out, or they're going to go try it. And one of the reasons I stopped kind of posting animals I kill is I just didn't want to. For one, I mean, I've helped people hunt in my unit a lot, in the units I hunt in, but I don't have to worry about someone asking or figuring that out. And because I know I can go through a picture and look up a ridgeline and go to Google Earth and find it. But yeah, as I was saying, I'd hike back in some areas 3, 4, 5 miles and scouting, and just wasn't finding the deer. I was finding some pockets of deer, but just nothing. And most of the deer I was finding were in spots. I mean, I was glassing from a dirt road. The biggest deer I found, that he was easily a 200 inch deer. He was about half a mile from a road. I mean, in areas that are overlooked. I've thought of that issue before, but it really clicked on me. It's like, why do I need to go hike past all these animals whenever I have pockets of deer that are half a mile to a mile off the road? They may be straight up and they might be on cliffs, but I can cover ground in one day. I can go find lots of animals in one day. I never have to leave my truck. And so that enabled me to get a few different game plans. And I ended up, during August, I scouted up 54, I still remember 54 branch antler bucks. With I think two of them I put in the 190 class, one in the 200 class, and then a good amount of 170, 180 inch deer in all little different areas. And so,
wow.
A few of them I had to hike in and find them, but majority of the areas, I split it into an area to where, all right, well, you're going to have your road hunters who are going to hunt in a mile or two. And for archery, majority of guys, I say, all right, so maybe say half the guys who have the tag in the unit, let's say they're going to want an easier hunt. And so they're going to want to hunt some low elevation. And so that splits half the guys who might hunt the country where I hunt. And so, but there go a lot of guys, oh, well, I want to go way deep in and get away from people. And so I had scouted those areas, didn't find anything, so I scratched those off. And so I really focused on areas that either are overlooked because maybe they're almost too easy to access, or they're just too hard to get to get up there, but they're not very far away. And so once I narrowed it down to that, I mean, I'd be sitting there and I'd be doing the whole thing. I'd be on the road and I'd see a truck coming. And so I'd have to kind of hide all my stuff and just pretend like I was just sitting on the ground, like eating breakfast or something. As soon as they passed by, I'd get out my scope again. And so a little sneakiness about it. But yeah, it was one of those things. I'm going to hunt where the animals are. I'd love it to be a great story where, man, I hiked in 10 miles and shot my deer and did that. But if there's big deer half a mile off the road, that's where I'm going to be hunting. I'm not going to go hike in and try to go find them way off. I mean, but I think that's the biggest thing I found and be able to help people with is finding those little areas that are in between the road hunter areas and the guys who go in at one. Because once you get in past 5 miles, then you start, if you're hiking in, you start competing with horses.
Yeah.
And
or potentially running into another road, you know?
Yeah. And that's definitely a not a very fun thing to do. I've done that before. You think you're way back in there and all of a sudden you come out on the road and you're like, I'm an idiot.
Done the same thing.
Yeah, there's Yeah, you just hope that no one's around and you just turn right around and walk back. I didn't even walk the road. I just walked right straight back up where I came from.
Yeah, so, yeah. That's cool.
But yeah, I'd say the biggest thing is being able to translate what you're seeing on the computer to what you're actually going to be seeing, hunting where the animals are, not walking past animals, or not walking past animals that you'd like to shoot. And then I'm already forgetting the one that you said it was the most important one.
Which one?
I'm blanking on it.
It makes total sense. I mean, there's a lot of scenarios where I've been, at least for elk hunting and even whitetail deer hunting. I mean, you don't have to be way back in. Everyone has this mentality of the Western mm-hmm. hunter, like I've got to go farther, I've got to get away mm-hmm. from the people. But again, like you touched on, when you get further back, you run into horses or those other hardcore guys. Mm-hmm. You're too close to the road. Maybe you get, and it's not even necessarily about being too close to the road. It's just what is a determining factor or a deterrent to keep mm-hmm. people away, and if there's deer there, there's deer there. You know, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Like, they're there. Like, go after them. Don't hike in aimlessly. I mean, if they're there, go after them, like you said.
You're exactly right. Actually, I have a funny story about that. My dad had a muzzleloader tag, and we were hunting an area, and they're kind of a lower elevation or unit. We call it the road hunter's paradox. I mean, there's just these roads all over this country, and it's this huge flat plateau. And, but it's one of the, during the middle of the week on Tuesday and Wednesday, no one would be there because it was a spot that all the guys from all the local towns came and hunt on the weekends. But then anyone who was hunting in our unit for a full week, they wouldn't hunt there because there's too many roads. And so one night I would go out, and a lot of those areas, I'd go out in the middle of the night after we got back in camp, and I'd go to a couple different locations and just use some location bugles off the road. Just try to pinpoint where some elk were if they're talking. And I'd gone over that to that area, and just, I mean, I was just in the middle of the county road, and I hit a bugle and had three or four bulls reply. So I came back, and I told my dad and his really good buddy, and I was like, man, I think we need to go try this area. And so sure enough, we pull up on this county road, and we had 7, 8, 9 different bulls talking to us. Whoa. And we ended up stalking a bull. It was hard to get far enough off the road to be able to legally shoot him. He was so close to the road. And this bull was a 300 class 6x6. I mean, like, and he's at a, we called it was a triangle intersection where there's three roads coming in. And we're like, man, we cut in, but we can't cut in because they're so close to the road. I mean, and we chased elk, I mean, all over these road systems. But by the time that Thursday came, there were guys camped all in that area, and all the elk were gone. And no one knew. Just the 2 days before, I mean, we've been just walking on the roads, calling an elk left and right. And kind of one of those little notches or niches that you find that no one who wants to hunt near a road is going to hunt it. But no, everyone who is hunting a road, they're always there on the weekend, and so no one's there in the middle of the week.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
And it was flag ground to hunt, which was a good break from the steep stuff we'd been hunting. So we're all for it.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, I've had to say I'm not going to sit here and tell people I hiked, you know, 3, 4, or 5 miles back in to kill my bull a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I was literally hunting 400 yards off the road in a meadow, mm-hmm. and killed my bull there. My buddy Connor, who I work with, he had an encounter with a 300 class bull literally within 100-200 yards off the road. I mean, there's no like recipe for where they're gonna be. They're just either mm-hmm. there or they're not, and there's different factors of different hunting pressure and reasons why they're there or not there. So you can never just like write an area off and say, there's no way mm-hmm. that a big mule deer can live here. There's no way an elk's going to be in this area. Mm-hmm. It's just, it is what it is. So it's cool to hear you say mm-hmm. the same thing.
Yeah, the only recipe you need is just to be out there and then always be holding on to your gun or bow. So I tell people if they're going to go take a dump or go take a piss, bring your weapon with you. Like, don't leave it 2 arm reaches away because you don't want to be halfway through doing a number two or something. And you hear an elk beagle and it literally scares the crap out of you. And then you drop your toilet paper and then it's just a mess. So
I've been in that same scenario actually last year. We won't get into that right now, but you know, it happens. Keep your weapon close. I like that.
That is the most important thing.
So let's talk a little bit about your gear selection and you know, what you're taking in for your style of hunting. Let's talk a bit about maybe your pack and spotting scope and some of your equipment that you're using for some of these high country hunts.
Okay. So quick rundown. Last year I was running a bunch of Sitka stuff. So I had their lightweight pants. I was running their, I think it was their Ascent shirt. I had a First Flight Down jacket I had gotten, I used and really, really enjoyed. And then I just brought my some Sitka rain gear. And so I was pretty light on the stuff. I think I only had, three top layers, and I would just wear one bottom layer. I'm pretty warm up there that time of year. I wear Cabela's Mendel's boots and then Merino base layer, Merino socks, Merino underwear. And then sleeping bag, just kind of have a camping sleeping bag. I don't even know the name of it. I know it's a 20 degree bag and it keeps me warm. I've slept in 10 degree weather in it and it's awesome. And I have this hunt particularly, I didn't use a tent. I was just sleeping out under the stars, but I have it's an American Eagle tent and I'll take out, and it's just kind of a one person tent, but it works well. Surprisingly really, really waterproof. For the cheap amount I got, I've slept in a couple of blizzards in it, and it's done remarkably well, I must say. And then the other biggest thing I tell people is I always have hiking sticks with me, trekking poles. I used to think it was only for old dudes until I packed out an elk and almost died in a river, then almost died in some willows, and I realized I may have a strong back, but a weak mind, and thinking I don't need a 4 points of contact. So trekking poles is one of those things I always have. Pack wise, I have a Stone Glacier pack. I got it four years ago. I think it's the Sky Archer. It's 6,000 to 7,000 cubic inches. It has the meat shelf. My bag will back away from my frame, and I can stick my meat in there. And I'm blanking on the guy who started, but the guy who made I think he's 6'4", 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", and I wanted something that would fit my stature, and that it's been a remark. I've never had any issue with that pack. It's been super lightweight. I've carried, I carried my mule deer out all in one load with all my gear. So I mean, it'll hold a lot of gear, and it's just been. It's been my best friend up there, I must say. Optics, me personally, I have some Cabela's, just their main brand, 12x50s. I don't recommend 12x50s for mountain hunting, but I have them for scoring whitetail here in Texas. We got to be within a few inches of our scores. And so, but then whenever I could, I will commandeer my dad's Swarovski's optics, which are my favorite. But on my budget, I cannot afford them. But whenever I can, A by 42s or 10 by 50s, and then also his scope, 20 by 60. But I can't remember the objective lens size. But as far as that goes, Swarovski up there. If you can afford it, especially if you're looking and having to dissect these mule deer at 3, 4, 5 miles away, trying to find just a little bit of a body or a little bit of an antler, looking high grass or the willows, optics are definitely a much needed tool and something that is definitely a necessity for that kind of hunt.
Yeah, for sure. That's one thing that always kind of piques my mind, because you have so much, you're above tree line or right at, and you can see a ways. So you need to take advantage of that particular advantage. So I always see guys with spotters and going that route, because if you're more mm-hmm. low elevation, you're kind of maybe more relying on terrain changes or pinch points or maybe feeding, you know, bedding, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But if you can use your eyes, you know, I can see how a spotter would be huge in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. And you can't hunt what you can't see. So
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that kind of gives us a rundown of your gear. Anything else on the gear side that kind of sticks out? Maybe that's more geared more towards these high country hunts.
I'll talk my bow a little bit. So I have it's kind of a I've yet to meet someone who shoots my bow. It's the it's by Matthews, but it's a MR8. It's his McPherson series. And it has 80 pound limbs on it. And so I tell people I like to be able to kill two deer at one time. And overpower them, but it's super flat shooting bow, and let's see, I was shooting arrows, just carbon aftermaths. I think they're weighing in at like 350 grain. I think they're 300 spine. And I was shooting shuttle tees, and so I think my total arrow weight or total arrow setup was right at 500 grains. And
oh wow,
I was shooting that at about 300 feet per second. So I was shooting flat out to 36 yards. So it's wow. definitely, that setup is definitely made for some of your longer shots out there. So I think that's one of the, things I found a real advantage, is having a real, real flat shooting bow, that, also can cover up if I hit a shoulder, it's pushing enough force with that heavy arrow that I can punch through some areas. If it wants to get Western on me, or if whenever I screw up, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But as far as gear goes, that's about it. My bow is my baby. I love that thing.
I bet. Sounds like a good setup. So we're talking about, you know, scouting, kind of, you know, getting into an area. We talked about gear. Let's talk about, you know, the first day of the hunt. And or maybe a couple days, whether you get in early and you've got a couple days to scout. Let's talk a little bit about like what you're doing maybe on your first couple days into that area. Are you more observing, still kind of glassing, trying to focus on, you know, finding these bucks? Are you kind of maybe setting up in these areas and just getting right into the thick of it right away?
So luckily, of course, leading up to, I've been able to scout this area for quite a while, but I guess the last 4 days I was really nailing down. All right, this is I had my target buck picked out and I was scouting him every day. And I was looking at ways to get in there. And my plan was as soon as that opening light on the first day goes, I'm going after him. Either that means if he's in an approachable area in the morning, great. But if he's not, I'll wait until the afternoon. So leading up, I would say scouting beforehand, especially on any hunt, knowing what the animals are doing, the patterns are doing, especially these mule deer, they'll bed down and get up. And so usually they'll bed down two or three times a day and get up and feed. And so being able just to get a rough estimate of when they're getting up and feeding and whatnot. And so after watching all these deer, the strange animals kind of have an internal clock in them. I was able to pattern that, all right, in between 9 and 10, they'd usually bed down between 12 and 1, 12 and 1:30. They'd get up and feed, and then they'd bed back down, and then they'd get up at like 4 or 5 and start feeding again. And so I actually didn't realize that I was doing this, but it kicked in that, like, I realized my window for being able to locate a buck, bed him down, say, at 9 in the morning, then I would have 3 hours to 4 hours, again, position. So that either whenever he got up to feed, I can move in or cut him off, or I can get close enough to him that whenever he got up to feed, I can send an arrow through him without him ever knowing. And so that the scouting beforehand leading up to the season was definitely something that was just a huge education in learning how these mule deer act, what they do, some body signals they give when they're actually getting up or when they're alert. I had the plan, as soon as the season started, I was going to hit it hard and, go after whatever buck gave me an opportunity. It was, it was going to be a balls to the wall. We were going to get it going.
Yeah. Yeah. So Talk to us a little bit about that, like, kind of bed to feed pattern. Like, so let's say you're up there, you're glassing at first light, whatever, you might see them feeding. Are they bedding in particular areas as far as like a north facing slope? Are they on certain contours or, you know, vantage points where they can see? Talk to us a little bit about how you see them and where they move to bed.
Yeah, so for the most part, these animals, usually it was the north, or usually I found them mostly on my north facing slopes. Of course, I find them everywhere, but percentage wise, they're usually with the big north facing slopes. Sometimes I'd find them, they'd be deep in some willows on a flat bench, or I find them up on top of a cliff. And so whenever I get these areas and just trying to locate them, I'd get my binos, and my mentality is I'm just trying to find a little piece of an antler. That's all I'm looking for, a little piece of an antler. And then it's really easy to find half a deer or see half a butt whenever you're just looking for a little piece of an antler. And so I would scan the area I'm about to look at and kind of get a lay of the land and saying, all right, well, there's a bench here, there's a bench there, there's water coming down right here that I have easy access to. And so I kind of pick out some points where I might think a deer would be, and then hit those first, and then kind of grid it from there, kind of go left and right a few times. And then once those areas were done, I get a wider span of things and just start doing big circles of the area, just nice and slow, picking out every single thing of grass. And sometimes I might look at an area for 30, 40 minutes, and then all of a sudden something I've been looking at the whole time ends up being a deer. And so focusing on those northeast facing slopes, I'd say up there in the high country, looking for just little bitty benches where that deer can bed down. And a lot of times I find them where they had a cliff behind them, and so they'd set up with their right up next to the edge of a cliff or a big rock, so they get a little bit of shade, and then but they always had a good vantage point in front of them. As long as I was in front of the deer, like if I was from the road glassing up, if there's vegetation, there's could be in the way, but I never had a deal where there was a big rock they were in front of. They always wanted to be seeing what was coming in front of them, because their idea is that, well, if I can get high enough, nothing can come above me. All my predators are come from below me. And if anything comes from below me, I can smell them and run off. And so I just took that mentality and just was very, very patient and just really meticulous on glassing, and was able to spot bucks and pattern bucks and that normally I don't think I would have. But yeah, I'd say just patience, and then just visualizing where a deer would be and then following through with that. And if that doesn't work, just put in the work and eventually something will pop up. And if it doesn't, you go to another area and try to find them, and just not giving up on it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All good stuff. Let's talk a little bit about, like, so once you've got one bedded, right, you've kind of mm-hmm. located the deer you potentially want to go after, you know, what are some of those advantages? Like, because you might see a really big deer you want to kill, but he might not be in mm-hmm. an ideal spot to kill him. Does that make sense? Like, talk to us a little bit about, like, maybe the setup you would like to see as, like, an ideal scenario for you to be able to move in and potentially get a shot.
So, I had in scouting and whatnot, I always, whenever a deer would bed down and I'm not making before the season, or I can't hunt them, I would, in my head, I would make a stalk. And so I'd see most of the time where they bedded, I mean, they were unreachable. I had some bucks. I mean, the nearest cover from them was 300, 400 yards away. I mean, stuff that it'd be hard to get a rifle in on them. I mean, you'd be taking 600, 700 yard shots in these big basins they're in. And so ideally, whenever you're glassing these deer, the higher up they are, the better, because the closer they are to that ridge or the highest point of the mound means the less distance you have to cover to where they might see you. So if you have a buck that's bedded just below a ridgeline, I mean, that's almost as perfect as you can get. Of course, watching your winds up there will be swirling a little more, but the longer you can stay out of sight from that buck, and move into the kill zone, the more likely you have a chance of being able to get in there and make something happen, just because you're limiting the possibility of failures. The more time you spend where you're with watching the buck or moving in and seeing the buck, and the more chances of them turning around, the more chances there might be in a buck behind a rock that you never even looked at. And that's something I ran into the first day of my hunt. I was moving in on some bucks, and I was so tunnel visioned on where they were going to be that I didn't even look to my left side, and I busted up a couple bucks. I mean, we're just hiding an area that I didn't even know was there, but I wasn't paying attention enough, and just basically just being lazy, I guess you could say. But it'd be an ideal situation to be somewhere. Of course, the higher up you are, the higher up they are, the higher up you got to hike. But if you have one bed and you're hunting them, you're gonna have to get above them anyways. So if you're gonna hike all the way up to the top, that's the only way to do it, really. I mean, for these high country deer, and something that's remain bedded for a while and is comfortable, and then if you're able to sneak in there within bow range, just wait it out. I would say wait, and don't pressure them to get up, don't booger them, just let him do his thing, because he's gonna be a lot calmer whenever he gets up. He'll start feeding, and now if your wind's starting to change, your wind's getting a little iffy, that may be an audible you have to call. But if you're in the middle of the day, as long as the storms are rolling in, that wind's going to be right in your face. And in my situation, I knew I was willing to wait an hour, 2-3 hours. I was willing to wait however long it took so that he would stand up on his own, so that he would be as calm as can be, so that I would have the time and be able to go through my process of shooting to make it happen. So.
Yeah, that's so good to hear you say that, because, I mean, you see a lot of these TV shows or something where they throw a rock and, you know, try to make a noise. And like you said, there's a certain scenario to do that. Maybe the wind's starting to switch. Maybe there's a, you know, another buck moving in. Maybe it's a different time of year. Getting dark, I don't know. But, like, you know, if everything is right and you're in position and you know you've got the advantage, wait them out, you know, let them – if they don't know you're there, it's just you're better off that way. It's basically what I'm gathering from you and what I've seen with my own experiences as well.
And I even relate that to elk. I tell guys that the less you have to call to get into the kill zone on an elk hunt, the better, because the less likely you're going to screw up, or the less likely – the bull's going to take it the wrong way and run off. So anytime you can just limit your known presence, or limit the animal being able to know that, hey, well, that rock came from somewhere. Like, I need to look at it, and maybe I may not be really alert, but I'm going to check it out. But the less you can be in that animal's mind, or less you can have an effect on his behavior, from what I find, that especially in the whitetail hunting world, as jumpy as those animals can be, the better. Patience and perseverance. I mean, it's hard. Especially your hunt up there, you're hunting the high country, you're running, gunning. You're ready to kill something. You've been hunting a long time, and man, that buck's 50 yards away. I want to shoot him now. If he'll just stand up and you throw a rock and he takes 3 bounds and looks back, and now he's
alert.
A distance, you don't know it, but. Yeah, and he's alert. He ran 3 bounds. You know, if he's 50 or 60 yards and there's a bush he's standing behind or something. I mean,
yeah.
And then you're not going to get a second chance, because if you want to draw on him, he's got to see you and he's going to run away. So, I mean, I had that happen. It's not a very fun experience. So.
Yeah, I can imagine that'd be frustrating. Do you ever run into a scenario? I'm sure you have, but like, you've got to make a judgment call, right? Like, maybe it's late in the day, or it's just not the right setup, that you kind of like make a decision like, yeah, I don't think it's good to go after him today. I know where he's at. Maybe I'll try tomorrow or the next morning. Do you find certain scenarios where you just kind of wait till the next day?
Yeah. So, I can get into my story on how my hunt went.
Yeah. Let's dive into that. That'll paint the whole picture.
I had that exact same scenario happen. Of course, these bucks had scouted him for 2 or 3 weeks, and actually the first morning, they were in a lower base. And actually, I know we had talked about like are we going to ambush them? Do you ever have an ambush spot? I actually set up in a good little ambush spot, and I had one doe walk 20 yards from me. I had a couple other does walk 40 yards from me, and I had the two big bucks in the group end up walking 90 yards from me. So my first ever hoorah, I'm dang near within bow range of these guys, and then just sitting there. And which would have been a good of a story for sure. It'd have been successful, but if I just told me, I just walked and sat there and they walked right by me. But from there I watched them go and bed up, and so went back to my truck. It was about 3/4 of a mile away, and I glassed them up until I saw where they bedded, and then I watched them for about 20 minutes to pick apart, and then I saw three bedded bucks, and so drove about 25-30 minutes around to the backside, parked, and just went straight up. It was about 3.5-4 hours of, every step I took, I could reach out and touch the ground in front of me with my hand. It was grueling. So I hiked up, I had a point mapped out, and I got to my little point, and I'm right above these bucks. And so I sneak out, and I start looking down, and I realized that there was four bucks with them, but the fourth buck was bedded and he was looking straight uphill. And so I'm just, that really kind of bummed me out, because these two big bucks, they were in a perfect position. They had a big cliff above them, it was probably a 10-15 foot cliff, but they were in a position that I think I really could have made a move on them. I could have snuck in there, and I'd already pictured in my head, once I got there, I had that buck who, he was looking back up my way. And so immediately I knew, I'm like, all right, well, it's become a waiting game. And 5 hours later of sitting there, all the bucks moved except the one who was looking straight uphill. And so that was definitely a test of patience, where they're just 150 yards away right there. I could probably sneak in there. I may bust a buck. I might get a shot. And but I told myself I was going to just wait it out. And came to 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. I ended up glassing up a buck. To visualize it, I'm sitting and my feet are facing north. And so off to my left, off to the west, there are my target bucks I'm waiting on. But off to my right, I see a buck that's bedded and he's way far away. And I'm like, all right, I'm gonna let these guys go. They're not in a spot I can kill them. I don't want to booger them. Hopefully I can find tomorrow and they'll be in a killable spot, and I'll go make a move on this buck. If I get him, I get him. If I don't and I booger him, he's just by himself and I get a little practice. And so he was a ways away, and I moved up into this high basin, and I had to cross a scree field of rocks that was about 300 yards, and I somehow did it without making a sound. I mean, I thought I was Pocahontas or something floating through it.
Ninja
it was
man.
Impressive, I must say. Yeah, no one saw it, but it was impressive. What wasn't impressive was whenever I snuck up on him and then peeked my head over too fast and he ran away. But I didn't locate. I knew about where he was, but I didn't locate the knoll he was at. And as I came up drawing, I thought he was going to be a little lower than he was, and that we were right at eye level as I came up. And so he was at 62 yards, and he stood up, looked at me, and was gone. And so as the long hike back to camp, I kind of took that. I was like, all right, well, looking at the positive, I didn't mess up those bucks. I realized what I did, and I realized the stalk I did. I need to be a little more slower, a little meticulous, and I need to really – before I started my hunt, before I started the stalk, I really needed to pick out my path and then the point of exactly where that buck was at. I'd used a couple rocks as a waypoint, or not a waypoint, but as my markers, whenever I got up there, I couldn't find the rocks. They weren't big enough. And so from that, just that one stalk, I realized that just pinpointing exactly that buck's location that I'm going after is going to, for one, increase my time or decrease my time of getting there, because I can take the most direct path. And then two, when I have to peek my head over, I'll know exactly where he's at. I'm waiting out those bucks for 5 hours. It definitely took, if I hadn't had a lot of experience, at least in the whitetail world, and waiting in a tree stand or waiting on the ground, I might have just run in there and boogered them into the next state. That was a long sit. It was hot up there too.
I bet that's some serious patience to be able to kind of, be able to handle that, the mental, the physical, the heat,
mm-hmm.
All that. That's pretty wild.
And so, made back to camp, cooked up some dinner over the fire, and had a game plan of what I would do in the morning. And I wake up right at first light, and I go to chop on my bucks, and they're not anywhere on the mountainside where I last saw them. And so, definitely a low. It was about an hour after first light, and so the sun's already up, and I can't find my bucks. I'm just like, man. And so I moved over to an opposite ridge, and sure enough, glassed them up. I saw them for about 10 minutes before they moved into an upper basin. And so as soon as I lost track of them, I ate a little, I had a granola bar, drank some water, and I just packed up my pack and just headed straight up the path I went, the other day. And so just hiking straight up, my thought process, they were heading into a huge basin that I had seen deer in. And so my idea was they were going to go in there and be in an unkillable spot, but I might be able to stay up there all day and at least glass them. And maybe if they move down to a lower area where there's some ponds, that I could get a move in on them. And so I had it set in my head it was locked in there pretty tight that's where the deer would be. And once I got to the top of this ridge, I started glassing, and to my surprise, these bucks were bedded on top of this ridge. I mean, they looked to be 50 or 60 yards from the crest of the ridge. And it was a buck I called 64, a big 6x4, and even bigger 4x4. And at that point, I realized, like, ooh, these bucks are in a very dangerous spot for continued life.
They're killable.
Yeah, they're killable. It finally hit me. I was like, man, those bucks are right where they need to be. And so, as I'm on top of this ridge, to my right is sheer drop off, cliffs and everything. To my left, there were cliffs and some crevices. And so, but I couldn't. I had to stay up in those, because if I went any farther down, there were actually deer in the basin below me. And I just wanted to be as invisible as possible. And so for about an hour and a half, I made my way through these cliffs and crevices. Not the safest thing, but like I said, you have to have a stupid factor to go get these mule deer. So I made my way through that, and just real slow, not kicking any rocks. And I actually made it to the point where I'd set the day before, and I knew that I was about 150 yards from these deer at this point. And so I knew the point I had to make it to. And so I came around the backside of them and then started coming up. And as I was coming up, and there were a couple little benches in there that a deer might, if they're motivated, they might sleep in. So I was actually having to make my way up a pretty steep incline. I was having to hold on to all fours going up. And as I'm climbing, I'm moving rocks, stepping, and then make another foothold moving rocks. So I'm not moving anything, nothing's falling. And I get up to where I'm not clipped out anymore. I get up to where I'm 30 yards from the top of this ridge. So I know these deer, they're in the kill zone right now. They're within 70, 80 yards. And this is the time where I have to make a good choice. I have to make my game plan to make some of the counts. And so there were three little saddles in front of me, and so as I was looking, I had a saddle straight in front of me, I had a saddle at my 10 o'clock, and then out of saddle, let's say if the hand was at 9:30, so just straight in front of me to my left and a little farther to my left, and they increased in elevation as they went up. My goal was to go up to the highest saddle, and that's where I thought the deer were. But in looking at it, it was all rocky, and there was no way I could sneak within 56 yards of a buck with that, but the terrain I was given. And so the next one, my second option was also rocky, and the third one was just this little grass saddle. And so I was like, well, I think I'll be farthest away from the bucks, but at least I'll be able to move in there. And if they get up in bed, and if they walk a trail down right under, they'll feed right to me. And so, my shoes are already off. So I start crawling up, just on my back, and I'm just inching up there, and I get right up, and I get up right to the top of the ridge, and I start looking through blades of grass. And in my mind, these bucks are 50, 60 yards away. And to my surprise, I get an antler, and I soon realize I'm like 15, 20 yards from a buck. And I'm like total heart jump. I'm like, ooh, I'm very close. Like, it almost surprised me that I've been hiking for so long, and all of a sudden I'm just within arm's reach, rocks throw away from an animal. And so I quickly realized it was the big 6x4. He had an inline kicker and a big deep forks, decent width and just perfect velvet. And up there that day at 13,000 feet, you don't get very picky on stuff you're shooting up there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Tell them, every 1,000 feet you go up in elevation, you add 10 inches of antler. And so, I laid on my back, and I inched forward, and I got to where I could see the top of his rack. And at this point, I'd started hiking at about 9, and at this point, at the point I got set up and ready for my shot, I was at 12:30. And I'm knowing these bucks are going to stand up, like, all right, by 1:30, 2 o'clock, these bucks will get up from their bed and feed. And so I'm like, I'm just going to sit here. I'm laying on my back. I have an arrow knocked. And I was actually super, super calm, ready to go. And then at 12:40, that all changed because that buck decided to stand up. And I don't know what I came down with, but I was shaking like a son of a gun, dude. It was
buck fever.
It was terrible. I felt like a little kid. I was like, I don't know what's happening to me. I'm like, I don't know what to do with my hands. my buck got up, and he fed right where he needed to feed. He fed towards my downhill part of the saddle, and so he was feeding to the lower area to where I could sit up and shoot him from. And so I kind of screeched over where I was laying on my back and ranged him. He was right at 38, 40 yards. And so, very makeable shot. And so this is the one part where I kind of regretted pulling 80 pounds. While laying on my back, I went to full draw, and then I set up and, aimed down. It was pretty steep decline down to him, and released my arrow and right over the back.
Oh no!
Yeah, it's a great feeling. That arrow is still fine today, dude. Oh man! And so the arrow flies over the back, and I get the learning point on that. I tell people is there were a couple different possibilities of why my arrow shot high. The first one is that I missed high. Second one, with any steep angle going up or down, if you draw while aiming at the target, your peep sight will be off. And so anytime you have a steep angle down or steep angle up, you always want to draw straight out and then bend at the waist once you find your peep sight. Because otherwise, whenever you don't bend at the waist that way, your peep sight changes, and that'll just mess up your yardages. And then also, the higher you go in elevation, the less oxygen there is. So any projectile that's going through the air will have less resistance. So it will fly at a more straight, it'll just fly better. And so my bow is shooting faster, so it's shooting flatter. And so what I'm really shooting at 38, 40 yards, my bow, what I'm aiming for, it's actually shooting way high. So I need to aim for, say I'm shooting 40 yards, I should aim for 35 or so. And so that was, through all that, within about 5 seconds, all that thought went through my head. And so after I miss, my buck takes 3 big bounds and stops. And so I lay back down and I grab another arrow on my quiver. I just tell myself, like, all right, missed high. He took 3 bounds. It'll be a touch over 40. His he's on a decline. And so my arrow will exit higher or enter low and it will exit high. So I told myself I'm going to put my 30 pin right in the middle of the shoulder and squeeze. And so I get the arrow again. And as I'm sitting up, I draw. And at this point, him and I like lock eyes. And it was like a Western movie. We just like have a stare down for a second or two. And I knew I only had 2 or 3 seconds to shoot once he realized what I was. And I shot. I heard the solid flap. And I waited about 2 seconds to track him, which I don't recommend. I jumped straight up, adrenaline pumping. I run right past the other deer was a Boone and Crockett. I run right past him, and he's like, what in the world? And run to where I shot my deer, and I look down to where I thought he was running at, and there's a deer running down there, and I'm like, man, my deer's not wounded. That's not him. And I look off to my right at the saddle to where I sat all day the day before, and there lay my buck no more at 12:42 on the afternoon on top of that saddle, dead as can be. So
wow.
At that point, I still have a video I have to send to you about my excitement in that moment. But at that point, I realized I'd just done something really special. And then I went back up to where I shot and hit my elevation to see what I was. And I released the arrow at 13,025 feet elevation. So
wow. Dude, that's amazing. And that's a really cool story.
It was truly a blessing to be able to be out there and be in that country. And to arrow anything up there was special. But to arrow a buck like that, I mean, the way it was, and just I think it was such a beautiful buck, such a beautiful animal, that I couldn't believe it. I was in shock. So
yeah. And velvet too, right? Was this like first week of September?
I actually was the last weekend in August.
Oh wow.
August 27th.
Nice.
Yeah, so
didn't waste any time.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, I just gone there and got it done, you know.
Like a pro.
But yeah, I knew exactly what I was doing. I'm a seasoned pro.
Need a camera crew up there next time.
Oh gosh, well, I don't know if a camera crew would want to go up there. but yeah, perfect velvet. Everything about him, I mean, I couldn't complain at all. The velvet was in good shape. He was real symmetrical and had a little kicker, and even had some eye guards. I mean, what else could you want a deer? So long story short, the pack out was terrible. Like I said, I didn't have any hiking sticks, and I wasn't going to make a second trip up there. And I somehow made it to the road. My cousin Josh actually came up, and he brought me water, luckily.
Josh.
I wouldn't give him any. Oh, yeah. So he actually saved my butt. I ran out of water 4 hours before that, so I was severely dehydrated, and I started hiking down, and he was a Cypress Sorize. He brought me a 2-quart thing of water, and I chugged it, and he's like, can I help? And I'm like, nope, I'm going to be stubborn. I told myself I was going to pack it out, but if you could break trail for me, that'd be great. And so he helped me on the way down, and it was only about a mile or so out, and then I ate very well that night. I ate a whole pizza by myself.
That's awesome.
But I guess the takeaways from that, and doing it solo, doing it by myself, was really fun. But definitely missing the camaraderie of whenever you get an animal down. I was texting my dad over satellite phone, and he was excited. It was like I was up there all by myself, but I was so excited by no one to share it with. If the only thing I could change would be, man, if someone could have been with me just to experience it. But then I realized doing it by yourself up there, that was definitely something that I don't know if I wouldn't necessarily take pride in it, but it's something that I really feel something that I accomplished that was a goal that I had set out for.
So. Yeah, that's something. That's something that's pretty, amazing. It's a special moment, and that's just a cool story, man. I mean, to be able to get it done at that elevation, what an experience! The terrain, the landscape, the everything about it. Just sounds like a hunt that I think any serious Western hunter should go after. And now I want to go, man. You got me fired up. I need a deer tag. What the heck?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. I wouldn't recommend waiting 9 years to get one. We need to find a unit that you only have to do in 0 or 1 year.
Yeah, a
so
couple
we can
years.
Do it a little more often.
Yeah, for
but,
sure.
But those muleys, they're fun, dude. It gets addicting. I've been researching units, what I can draw for no points, 1 point. It's something I've really fallen in love with. The high country stuff up there with those animals. It's a blast. It's awesome.
For sure. And, you have a blog, website yourself. Tell us a little bit about that. Cause you wrote an article about this exact hunt, correct?
Yeah. So it's called Over the Next Ridge. It's just overthenextridge.com. I started kind of writing about some of the stuff I did in Colorado. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. And I had a couple buddies back home and some relatives who just wanted to hear more about my stories. And so started putting some words together and found out I was actually somewhat decent at it whenever I was writing about stuff that I really cared about. And so I enjoy writing anything from – I've written stuff like a bow hunter's prayer to little poetry deals I've written in the mountain because I had to rhyme words because I was sitting there all day and had to keep my mind sharp. My best buddy Marshall says I should go write Hallmark cards for a living. So he gives me a bunch of crap about that.
That's hilarious.
But he actually went mule deer hunting and came back and he said he was sorry for anything he ever said. He didn't realize how hard mule deer hunting was. But just started writing about some of my experiences in the hunting world, and mainly about how you can relate it over to life and doing hard things and pushing through bad circumstances and just finding ways to get the job done. And the deer story we've been talking about, I labeled it Velvet at 13,000 feet. So I didn't post the deer on social media until January, so I waited a few months. I had some buddies posted for me, but I didn't really write the story or tell anyone about it through the likes of the internet through January, or just I may have been December. So
got it.
Every once in a while I'll get the urge to ride, and whenever hunt season comes around, it's a little more easier to put things together. And it's something I've just enjoyed doing, and my hope is that I can just help a couple of people learn more about the West and learn a little more about themselves through the world of hunting.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'll post a link to that in the show notes and everyone can go check that out. And definitely really cool stuff and great story. A lot of good tactics, a lot of good experience, the good, the bad, the ugly. I think a lot. Well, it's what makes us better, man. It's the experiences, and that's one thing too. I mean, you just got to get out there and do it, right? I mean, we can talk about tactics and strategy, and it certainly helps. Like, this is great, man. I can't wait to actually do a hunt of my own now. But like, you know, you just got to put yourself in that position and stay persistent, and stay sharp and stay focused, and keep after it, and things will come together. And that's really cool stuff.
I agree 100%. You're absolutely right.
For sure, man. Well, hey, it's been great talking with you. We'll have to get you on at some point again and talk about some other hunts and whatnot. But, you know, until then, I really appreciate you being on the show, and you have a great evening, all right?
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me, Adam.
All right, and there it is, another episode in the books. Thanks again for tuning in. Thanks again to Jason for coming on the show. Really, really cool story. Great hunt. I cannot wait to do a high country archery mule deer hunt myself. I know this is something that Dan Johnson, Dan the man of, who started this whole crazy Sportsman's Nation thing that I'm a part of, But he's talked about a high country mule deer hunt for a while. So hopefully this inspired you, Dan, and everybody else out there. And I can't wait to do this thing. I'm seriously considering, I think I need to for next year. 2019 archery mule deer hunt. Let's put it on the books. Later this year, I'm going to try to get a leftover rifle mule deer tag, maybe second season, maybe first season. And just kind of get my feet wet with a rifle. I'm an archery hunter at heart, but hey, sometimes it's fun to test out some new equipment. So definitely on the books. So that's that. Thanks again to Jason. Hope you guys learned a lot. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you go to subscribe at sportsmansnation.com. You can also subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to this podcast at. Give us a 5-star review. If you like what you're hearing, you like in the episodes, give me a 5-star review on the Sportsman's Nation Western Big Game feed. Much appreciated. Again, head over to transitionwild.com if you're planning a Western Colorado elk hunt for 2018. Go over there, subscribe, give me your email. I won't spam you. I swear to God, I'm not going to spam you. But go get that. It's a free download, 10 pages. It's going to show you, you know, scouting, where to hunt, when to hunt, gear, tactics, and inspiration. So a little freebie on the site right now. Go get that, transitionwild.com. Check us out, Sportsman's Nation, on Facebook, Instagram, Transition Wild. Follow me there on Instagram, Facebook, and keep on keeping on. Again, big shout out to Heads Up Decoy, a partner of the podcast going forward for the remainder of 2018. Check them out, headsupdecoy.com. All right, that is it. I've taken up enough of your time. This has been definitely a long episode, but jam-packed with lots of info. So until next time, we'll talk to you soon.